episode of Down to the Struts, the podcast about disability, design, and intersectionality, where we uncover the building blocks for a more just, inclusive, and accessible world. I'm your host, Kutsia Naki. Today, you'll listen in on my conversation with Day Al-Mohammed. Day is a lawyer, a writer, and a filmmaker, committed to designing laws and policies that ensure access and inclusion for disabled people and to bringing disability history and culture into our collective consciousness. Day and I talked about her approach to transforming social and cultural attitudes about disability as an essential tool that walks hand in hand with advancing policies that ensure rights and legal protections for disabled people. Day wants people to see disability culture as cool, a worthy objective, I think. Okay, let's get down to it. Day, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I am super excited to be here. And hello, everybody.
You are so many things. You are an advocate, a policymaker, a filmmaker, an author. Can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about the journey that led you onto all of these paths at once?
I've worked in disability policy for a long time in a variety of kind of legislative and executive kinds of arenas. I've done employment, I've done education, I've done accessibility and technology, I've done healthcare, and a lot of it relates to disability, some of it on race and ethnicity. In general, a lot of the work has been kind of support for marginalized populations. I even spent part of a summer working at the UN, the International Criminal Court, for the preparatory commission that was designing it, and it was working on plans as it relates to reparations and victims of genocide. I most recently completed my tenure as the White House Director of Disability Policy, and I currently work in the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and OSHA at the U.S. Department of Labor. I'm a big believer when it comes to making change, right? So policy is one way. The other is when we talk about impacting culture, right? You can write all the laws you want in the world, but we still have to have people to be willing to follow them. And so I'm a big supporter of things that impact culture, and being a little bit of a nerd and a geek, a lot of that is focused around fantasy and science fiction. And part of that also is because the idea that science fiction in particular, as a genre, is very much about social critique and does it in a way that allows people to think about what's right and what's wrong in our society in a way that puts it almost a little bit a step away so it's easier to see. I'm a regular host on Adobe Radio's Geek Girl Riot with an audience of about 100,000 listeners. I do a lot of writing. I also started moving into film. I'm a founding member of Forward Doc, which is Documentary Filmmakers with Disabilities. And I am currently working on a docuseries of disabled leaders for American Masters PBS. And I'm also the proud producer of the feature documentary Unseen. And other than that, I live in Washington, D.C. With my wife and Renee Brown.
I had the great privilege to work with you on Unseen as the impact producer and got to see some of your brilliance at work. You're both a lawyer and a media maker. You were talking about how culture is important to policy because policy can't exist in a vacuum on paper and it requires people to implement it. Can you expand a little bit more about how the law and media together and separately can be used as tools to dismantle ableism and other types of marginalization?
There's a study done several years ago in the UK. The idea was looking at how do you remove stigma around disability? And it found the number one way to help reduce stigma around people with disabilities was, one, for them to spend time around people with disabilities, right? Because if you're with somebody, it helps allay fears. It helps disperse with some kinds of stereotypes you might believe, things like that. The second most effective way to address stigma was through media, because if you can't be with somebody with a disability or me with them, guess what? What you see and what you learn from media is the way you will see and perceive them. And that's what will shape what you think about folks. So the thing is, if you're exposed then to stereotypes and to these ideas that devalue the lives of people with disabilities, then your views are going to be that. And I think one of the things that brought that very much home was in the last few years with COVID. insofar as we are in a global pandemic, we have hospitals that are short on resources. And the general idea is, hey, folks who need care should get care, of course. And there are protections that have been put in place, right, that make sure that folks with disabilities aren't discriminated against. However, during this time of pandemic, what was happening is that there was this belief that folks with disabilities' lives were less valuable. They were more pitiable. They were less successful. And so they were given less care, less quality of care, denied care, like to the state there are folks who had to file lawsuits to get themselves seen. And of course, man on the street's going to be like, yeah, they're folks with disabilities. They're actually more likely to die. And the truth is, depends on the disability. So there are folks who had disabilities that had absolutely nothing that would impact their ability to survive COVID, yet they were being denied care. Why? Because the idea is, you have a disability, gosh, oh my gosh, you are deemed as less. You are less valuable to society. You are pitiable. You are this whole idea. And these are folks who are doctors, nurses. These are folks who supposedly have spent years of their lives studying the human body. They are learned. They've gone to college. They've gotten advanced degrees. And yet they are falling victim to the belief in the same stereotypes. And the direct result of people believing these myths about disability was that people with disabilities died. For me, that was a straight up example of where, yes, we have laws in place that you can't discriminate against somebody with a disability. And because of the cultural impact, folks with disabilities still died. And so that in many ways is one of the reasons why I think that more inclusion of disability within media and more representation, both on screen and actually behind the camera, makes a difference. Because the more folks within a broader culture, non-disabled folks, actually see representations of disability that are authentic, realistic, and place value on individual human life, then that is the best way we have to actually really address some of the discrimination and bias that we're seeing.
I'm curious for you, Day, in your own personal story and your own journey with disability, was that true for you? Was there a point at which in your growing up, in your sort of origin story, where stories of others with disabilities started to reshape how you thought about your own disability? And where was there like a turning point for you in that regard?
I don't think I have a turning point. I'm still looking for it. I think I'm still looking for those pieces and those stories, and I'm not seeing them. And so I want to make them. Or I talk to other people who are working. I'm like, that's a great story. The world needs to see it. So in many ways, I think the idea was, it's not seeing a story that became a turning point. It was seeing the lack of stories that became the turning point. And I'm not sure that was any one individual moment. I think it just slowly started growing. When I was in law school, I got the opportunity to intern at the Missouri State Legislature for Representative Bill Boucher. And he was putting forward a piece of legislation around the employment of people with disabilities. He was a non-disabled man, retired electrical engineer who was elected to office. His wife was a school nurse. And he thought, this is a great idea. This is the right thing to do. But you know what? I should put my money where my mouth is. I should walk the walk. And so I should get a disabled intern. And this man didn't know anything about disability, but he wanted to do it right. And so I became his intern through luck and circumstance. And it was wonderful because I learned so much about policy from him. And in many ways, I think he learned a lot more about disability and what folks with disabilities are capable of during that time. And I think from that point on, I got really excited about policy. I think that's one of the reasons, even though I have a JD, the idea of practicing law wasn't what interested me. Because to me, that I looked at that and I was like, but that's trying to resolve a problem after the problem's already occurred. You can only come up with the best answer in a bad situation. But if you're working on the legislative side, you are actually developing the policies. And if you do it right, then there should be fewer of those problems that arise.
Is there a project that you've worked on that recently you feel really shifted the narrative about disabled people are and what they have to contribute?
Unseen, which is a feature film directed by Seth Hernandez, and it follows aspiring social worker Pedro and the restrictions he faces as a blind, undocumented immigrant on his way to get his college degree and be licensed and go on from there. And I think the toughest thing in that film has been the idea of how this young man can follow his dreams, right? It's what everybody wants to do. And at the same time, obstacles that come in the way based on the way our society has built itself. Some of that is because of his undocumented status. Some of it is because of his visual impairment. But it isn't just about the issues that arise. It's about the community that's built around that and how he builds himself. And then also one of the things somebody says, the story seems to meander almost the way his life does. And it's because he's been forced to find these other ways of doing things. And I really love the idea that it's not a story that follows the traditional, the moment you do an immigrant story, the moment you do an undocumented person and the undocumented person story, and the moment you do a blind person story, everyone assumes it's an overcoming story. Here's this person and they had these big obstacles and they overcame them and rah, rah, isn't that great? And the fact of the matter is most of us are pretty regular folks who are just getting by just like everyone else. And there's good and there's bad, and we all figure out ways to work through it. And in many ways, the story is so much more authentic because it very much hews closely to that truth. And I think one of the things that the director did was to make sure that to tell the story, one, he wanted to make sure he worked with the protagonist. So he worked very closely with Pedro. But two, was to make sure that the folks on the team, our producers, our camera folks, our editors, everyone, in many ways, have an authentic understanding. So there are folks on the team who are blind. There are folks on the team who are undocumented. We have a lot of LGBTQ folks on the team. And actually, I believe the team is majority people of color. And the idea was to offer the kind of nuance to the storytelling versus the kind of flat, raw stories that usually make it. This made sure we could actually capture that in a way that's meaningful.
And what was your role specifically on the film, and how did that bring meaning for you?
So I and Felix and Dara are two of the producers on the film. We started real early. So one of the things as a producer is you end up covering a lot of ground. So we worked on things with distribution. We worked on things with regard to paperwork and some stuff with contracts and making sure people are protected. We did some line production type work, which is logistics and making sure that everything is set up well for everyone. I know one of the things that I wanted to make sure was a big part of what we did is we made sure that anything we did not put Pedro at risk. And so whatever we could do to provide as much support in that realm as well. There's also the creative elements of working through with the film and the story, also looking at staffing and crew. So in many ways, one of the nice things about being a producer, even though most folks don't hear about it as much, is you get to see a film all the way, almost from an idea stage, all the way through to the end until it is on the screen and beyond sometimes. And so it has been fabulous working with this team. And I think set really went out of their way to make a really good vibe and that everyone feels heard. And the idea is we try to make sure that we work very well through consensus. So it's a very different way of working on a film. And I think it's one that I would encourage more crew and more teams to take on.
I always wondered what exactly a producer does. So given all these diverse experiences you have had in your career, both as an artist and a filmmaker and a lawyer, what advice would you have for young disabled folks who are trying to pursue their own paths?
Share the candy. Right? When good things happen, if you can, you share the experiences, you share opportunities with other folks in your community, particularly those who might be younger, who are still working their way up. Also those who might be willing to share back with you. I'll give an example where this idea first started for me. There are very few Black men working on the Hill as legislative staff. And the story I heard was there were two young Black men on the Hill. And one of the things they did when they first got started was when one of them was invited to a reception, he'd bring the other as his plus one. When one was invited to write an article, if he was too busy, it couldn't, he'd say, hey, I've got this other person who's great, and make sure the opportunity passed the other. And the idea was, you're not giving up your opportunities, but the idea is when you have an abundance, the idea is, oh, I know this person, you should talk to them. Or if there's something that's not quite right, rather than taking it or doing it, or just saying, I'm sorry, I can't, passing on. And between the two of them doing that back and forth, both of their stars began to rise because both of them were in the stream of opportunity. And so I'm a strong believer in share the candy, right? So when good things can happen, you want to be able to work with other folks, because what happens is by doing that, more folks from our community get advantages. But also, honestly, it's also good. It's good for you because it can come back and it can lead you into paths that you didn't have before. Because one of the toughest things about, for many of us with disabilities, and actually for many other marginalized communities, we don't necessarily always have as broad a network into as many places as we would like to. And the moment we start doing something like sharing the candy with somebody else we have, then automatically that network gets larger, especially if it's somebody who's, who, like I said, they have to share the candy back with you. But the idea is that's one of the biggest benefits. The second thing that I would say is find something that you like to do, that you love, hobby-wise or whatever else, that has nothing to do with disability. I think one of the most frustrating things for me, particularly with young folks, very young folks with disabilities, was they get very excited. I'm like, I'm going to be an advocate and I'm going to make all these changes around disability and that's sweet. And everything that they want to do is around that. And I said, well, what do you do for fun? And they didn't usually have a good answer. And I think that bothers me, because when the whole rest of the world is reducing us to nothing more than our disability, we shouldn't be doing that to ourselves, right? We should be well-rounded people. We should have things we like to do, go hiking, play video games, watch films, write books, whatever. It doesn't matter. But, you know, have things that you love to do that have nothing to do with your disability. So those are my two little pieces of advice.
Those are great pieces of advice. Share the candy and have hobbies. Can you tell us about your newest project, Renegades, which is going to air on PBS next year, and share about how it came to be and what do you hope to achieve with it?
My first documentary was called The Invalid Corps, and it was about disabled Civil War soldiers. I was fortunate to have it screen at Superfest in San Francisco. And it was amazing to see your film in front of an audience. But, and while that was cool and exciting, what caught my attention was folks afterwards who said, I had never known this about disability history. I'd never known this about our community. And one of the ideas that I had been playing with previously had been about more broader knowledge of disability history. This was Civil War disabled soldiers, but how about something bigger? One in four adults live with disabilities in the U.S., but despite its prevalence, disability and disability history is this like marginalized topic, and it's both underrepresented and misrepresented. The Annenberg Inclusion Initiative shows that only, I think, 1.9% of all speaking characters shown in films have a disability. That number hasn't changed in the 8 years they've been analyzing films. And if we talk about disability history and culture, right? A survey of educators at K-12 schools across the country, more than 50% of them said that in 2021 and 2022, they had never taught a lesson or part of a lesson that directly addressed something about disability history. Another 36% said, we did it maybe one or three times last year. And I'm like, so basically you covered Helen Keller and FDR. That's probably who they did. And if they got somebody modern, maybe it was Stevie Wonder, right? That gives us the holy trinity of disability. And of those folks who did teach disability history, 80% said they had to write their own lessons. And so just from that experience with the Invalid Corps and from looking what's happening in both film and in education, we're missing a large part of American culture and history. The disability community is missing a huge part of our history. We see things like Crip Camp, which is awesome and amazing. And it's, this is great. This is the protest movement. This is disability history and disability rights. And I'm like, well, we were around a lot longer than then. So there's this audience that's basically hungry to hear more about themselves. What I wanted to do was to develop a series of documentary shorts showcasing the lives of little known historical figures with disabilities, like all the way from the very earliest days of America as a country all the way to today. And I want to talk about these folks, their impact and their contribution to U.S. society, not just that they live, but how they are driving and they were transforming American society. I want it to be a chance for us to look at disability culture and bring it to a broader audience. I think the joke I tell folks is I want a non-disabled kid watching a digital short about a disabled historical figure and go, I don't want them to think about the person being having a disability. I want them to look at it and go, oh, that person's cool. I want disability to be cool. And so 3 years ago, I had put together part of a pitch deck and this idea saying, here's what I want to do. This is loosely, but the budget would be, and started trying to find someone to pick it up. And this is where that share the candy does come into play. And while I had worked with other folks and someone had passed along that pitch deck, and I started having a conversation with American Masters about a series of digital shorts about folks with disabilities. And it sounds like this, oh, it all happened, it's magical. I'm like, no, we had to start early on to go, is there interest in this? Does it work? There's a series of posts on the PBS Made website, and they're profiles of three different folks with disabilities in history. And it's just a little bio snippets of them just to see, is the audience interested? Do people like reading it? And what was great was it proved that, look, people are reading this. Actually, the readership for those posts was higher than some of the regular posts put up on their site. So it's, look, proof. And then in 2021, they provided funding saying, okay, it looks like there's interest. Let's film a pilot. That year, I set out to write and direct, and I brought on Amanda Upson to produce the series. And our executive producer was Charlotte Mangin, who American Masters introduced me to. That way we'd have someone who had a lot of experience producing to help make it happen. And between us, we decided we would do a short biography of Kitty O'Neill. And I'm like, we wanted to find someone who was exciting and interesting and vibrant. And so Kitty O'Neill was a race car driver and a stunt woman. Her claim to fame is that she was the fastest woman in the world. She was in a drag, so she raced across the desert and she broke the women's land speed record. And it was awesome. She didn't just break it. She broke it by more than 200 miles an hour. So she blew past it so fast, they were afraid she would break the men's record. And the problem is, right, when you do that kind of racing, it's expensive. Those kinds of cars, like the fuel they run on, it's, you know, $1,000 a second sort of a thing. That's how expensive it is. So they'd contracted her to beat the women's record, but they contracted with someone else to beat the men's record. And they couldn't have a woman be the fastest person in the world. And so they pulled her from the car and they wouldn't let her race it again because they were too afraid that she would beat the men's record. And I was like, it's this amazing, almost a little bit heartbreaking story. And sadly, she did never get the chance to go back and try again. So she actually turned towards doing stunt work. And she was known for high falls was her specialty. And she also did a lot of things where you set yourself on fire, which, let me say, back in the 70s was pretty dangerous. Not that it's not dangerous now, but back then, I'm like, I'm imagining it much more so. And the fun thing is she was the stunt double for Linda Carter, who played Wonder Woman, and for Lindsay Wagner, who played the Bionic Woman. And here's the thing, Kitty O'Neill was deaf. So a deaf woman is both Wonder Woman and the Bionic Woman. And yet nobody really knows her story. And so we were so excited to be able to say, let's tell people about this stunt person who's Wonder Woman, you know, and held the land speed record for more than 30 years, who has a disability. The fun thing is, part of the episode focuses on Kitty's story and that coolest factor of her. The second part actually has a deaf expert, Dr. Resonette. She actually talks about the concept of deaf gain, the idea that everyone thinks about hearing loss. But the thing is, within the community, there's this idea of deaf gain and what is gained from that. And so what it is we wanted to bring some ideas that are common to the community to a broader audience. And so that was the other thing that we did with that episode. And like I said, we want it to be light. We want it to be a fun. We have a fabulous host, Lachi, who's an EDM musician. And we want it to be, have a host to be able to act as our guide along the way, who will ask the same kind of ridiculous questions we all ask. And when she got a chance at visiting with a good friend of Kitty's who had the dragster that she won some of the land records in, and he said, oh, do you want to sit in it? She was like, I can sit in it, and was super excited because I'm like, yes, because that's what we'd all want to do. If we were right there in the moment, can I get in the car? Would be the first thing we'd ask. And so we've got this mix of like history and disability culture and just a little bit of fun. And so that's our goal with Renegades. And the pilot was in the top 15 of all the videos on PBS's American Masters YouTube account. We picked the idea of Renegades because we wanted to recognize how often folks with disabilities were accomplished or successful, did so operating outside the mainstream cultural and societal expectations. It's a chance we can kind of examine these fundamental concepts like identity or community or normalcy from a disability culture perspective. These are folks who actually were really awesome, and they deserve to be a part of everyone's history. The stories that make it into history books and that make it into documentaries tend to be told by the dominant culture. And so this is a chance for us to tell our own stories. One of the flat out requirements we made is that it's disabled documentary filmmakers who are going to be telling the stories. Each of these episodes has a disabled team with writers, producers, directors who all have disabilities. That way we make sure we capture that nuance and that we get a chance to authentically tell our own stories.
What happens next?
But I think that's the fun part is you just heard the idea, this and this fun, and PBS just made the announcement. But here comes the work. Now comes the, we're building the teams. We're selecting the profiles of who we're going to profile. We're looking at, all right, where do we want to shoot? Because if you think about profiling somebody, do you do it where they're born? Do you do it with somebody who knows them well, which is what we did with Kitty O'Neill? Do you do it where their home is? Do you do it at a museum that might have a lot of their materials? Who do you want to interview? Which experts are the ones who are best? And how do you like connect what disability cultural issue do you think is best reflected by this person's life? So we could have talked about Kitty O'Neill, and we talked about it and the idea of death gain. Another story that we didn't go into, which would have been great, which is the difference between Black ASL and white ASL. Because at one point in time in history, just like regular schools are segregated, so were schools for the deaf. And then later on, when the big push came towards oralism and speaking only, many folks within the white community were pushed that way, and many lost access to ASL, whereas the Black community can trace their sign language all the way back without kind of an interruption. So there's this interesting story there that we didn't get to cover as much in a 10-minute short, but because we found the idea of deaf cane was a tighter connection to Kitty's story. So figuring out what is the element we want to put forward is another piece of that. It then comes the building the schedules, building the budgets, and then actually going out and going into production. So we are just at the beginning of what is probably almost a year-long project.
That's an incredible, Day. And I wish you and all the teams all the best. And I've spoken about this and discussed this issue with so many of my guests on the podcast at various points, this lack of, this absence really of disability history and culture in what we teach our children, in what we teach ourselves. And that has disadvantages and damage both for non-disabled and disabled people alike, because we lose these essential elements and these important characters in our collective story. When you have a shared identity and shared history with people, that is tremendously powerful, and it's galvanizing. And I'm really hopeful that this project that you're embarking on with so many other disabled folks is going to do that for so many people who have never saw themselves in the stories we tell about our country, about our world. So I'm personally really excited for this project to release and excited to promote it and share it in whatever way I can through this platform. Where can our listeners find you, Day?
So the easiest place to find me is actually at dayalmohammed.com. So dayalmohammed.com. I do have a link there to some of the film work. If you look for Kitty O'Neill PBS, actually it will show up on a general Google search. And we have an audio described version, we have a captioned version, and we even have ASL. If you have an interest in science fiction, I would urge you to pick up The Labyrinth's Archivist, which is a science fiction novella. And this is one of the reasons I love my publisher, Falstaff Press, because they said they were looking for science fiction novellas. And I sent a note back going, I have a murder mystery in a fantasy setting. The main character, who is our detective who's solving the mystery, is queer, brown woman who is also blind. And they said, send me the first chapter. And I sent them the first chapter. They go, this is great. We'll send you a contract. Finish the book. And so there's a novella out there with a blind detective. There are no superpowers, no fancy. Figures out it's the way as blind folks, we actually operate in the world. And guess what? We could still solve a mystery, which is what this is. The main character, Azulea, lives in the Great Archive, which is modeled off the Great Library in Alexandria. So there's a lot of more like Middle Eastern style fantasy as she tries to discover who murdered her grandmother.
Thank you so much, Day. It was such a pleasure to sit down and chat with you and get to know you more.
Thank you. This was great and a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to Down to the Struts. This episode was produced by Alana Nevins and me. Our social media manager is Avery Annapol, with special thanks to Claire Shanley for designing our logo and to Eiffel Gangsta Beats for our theme music. For more about the podcast, visit us at downtothestruts.com. Follow us on Instagram and X at Down to the Struts, and join our Facebook group, Down to the Struts Podcast. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, Getting Down to It, on Substack. You can also find us at our new home on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you love to listen. Stay tuned for our next episode so we can get back down to it.